This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 12:36, FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you here. And great to have this man on. Now, he joins us quite a bit to talk about what's going on in Montgomery, District 105, Representative Chip Brown. But you and I have been talking about Afghanistan for a long time on this radio station, correct? I mean, it's been going on, well, probably, what, 7 years ago or something like that? 5, 6 years ago when we were last talking about the Bergdahl situation and beyond that.
Yeah, it was. You know, I came on one day and it just kind of came up in conversation about different things that I'd seen in Afghanistan. And then I came back on the day that they released Bo Bergdahl and, you know, let people know what a traitor he was.
Let's talk about what years were you there?
I was there in 9 and 10, and then I went back in 12 and 13. And I joined the National Guard week after 9/11, and then I was in a unit out of Montgomery, and we deployed for Iraqi Freedom in 2007, and we were gone for 15 months. But the bulk of my time I actually spent with U.S. Central Command in the forward headquarters in Doha, actually in Qatar. And then I had an injury, and I had to get out, let's put it that way, because of my back injury. I had a back injury, and I was non-deployable. So I thought I had some more to offer, so I had an opportunity to go to Afghanistan and work as an advisor, and I headed up a nationwide satellite network for NATO and U.S. forces, Afghanistan, and the International Security Assistance Force. And I had 26 locations across the country and was based out of the NATO, the International Security Assistance Force headquarters in Kabul. And then when I went back the second time, I was what's called a watch officer and a thing called the Situation Awareness Room. And we oversaw the war, basically. We monitored what was going on every sector, and it was we answered to the NATO commander and to the U.S. Forces Afghanistan commander, which was General Allen at the time. And my boss actually was a Marine Royal Commando colonel. It was a multinational effort, so I worked with Brits, Spanish, Italians, Germans, French, even a Ukrainian was in there. And so I saw a lot, met a lot of people, and actually have some good friends, you know. And one of the things, Sean, that struck me from all the time I was over there was that, you know, I like talking to people. I mean, that and politics kind of go hand in hand, you know. And I would make a point of every day I had people I would go and have tea with and talk about politics, and they let me know what was really going on in their minds. And as early as the first time I went over there in 2009, the big fear, the thought was, you're going to leave us and we're all going to die because we helped you. And you're going to leave us like you did in Vietnam. And, you know, I mean, what do you say? I just told people, try to get out early, you know? I mean, because you had to figure this day was coming. But no one could figure it would happen the way it happened. And that's the disgraceful part about it to me, is the way that we just seen a total lack of leadership. And I mean, no leadership and no plan. I mean, there's so many plans that have been drawn up since 2001 by the military and agencies, government agencies, about how to get out of Afghanistan and how to safely extradite our people from Afghanistan. And they threw them all away. They didn't do anything right. They didn't follow any of the, not just the playbooks that are the military playbooks, but just the common sense playbooks.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense. It's insane. I mean, people are dying. And the sad thing is, I know people inside of Afghanistan. and I know what's going on. And a lot of what you hear on the mainstream media is not true, what's going on. And it's a shame. People are dying. People are, they're hunting people down. And I don't see a solution to this the way that they are going about it, where you're either not going to end up with a massive hostage situation, a scale which we've never seen, or you're going to end up with a lot of Americans dead or a combination of both. I just don't see, I don't see any other way out of it. The way they are executing this is going to lead to a lot of bloodshed.
If just joining us, talking to Representative Chip Brown, Ed, but at the same time talking about his time in Afghanistan, let's talk specifically, and then I want to get back into this tactical question, but a personal one, trying to get one of those people that you knew out of Afghanistan. Can you walk us through this, who this person is, and the process of getting them out?
Sure, I'll be happy to. I'm not going to call him by his regular name, It sounds odd, but the truth of the matter is we look at the Taliban and we say, okay, they are a, I hear sixth century all the time. I don't know how we got on that, but people will say, how did a sixth century force beat a 21st century force?
Mm-hmm.
But the reality of it is, oh, they're brutal and they are barbaric and they don't value human life at all, but they are extremely sophisticated when it comes to social media, electronics, and they have people all around the world that are assisting them. I mean, they have a huge drug operation that out of Afghanistan and Pakistan that supply a lot of the funds for opium and ends up being heroin, but because they grow poppies in Afghanistan. But, they're funded by Iran. They have money sources inside the United States, Western Europe. Pakistan is their biggest ally. So they monitor what's going on. So for that reason, he has family that I know are trapped there, and so I won't call him that.
Fair enough.
I'll call him A.
Okay.
And so anyway, on the, make the story kind of quick. Friday, I had a conversation. He had called me a couple times recently, and who this individual is, when I went to Afghanistan the first time, I was tasked with bringing over a team of Afghan Americans that they needed to get safely to Kabul. And so I brought these guys with me, and I think we had 10 of them. And they were all – one of the things people have to remember – a lot of the U.S. citizens that are Afghans, they fled when the Soviets came in. You know, I mean, I know people that could tell you stories about being 10 years old and having to make their way through a desert, hiding in the rocks, because the Taliban, the Russians, were looking for people and, making their way to Pakistan, refugee camps. I mean, all of that stuff. So these people were Americans. You know, had been U.S. citizens for years. So, one of them was a extremely successful, I'd say, millionaire restaurant owner that sold all of his restaurants. And the one thing they had in common was they wanted to go back to Afghanistan to help their people to set up a free country, and that's what they wanted to do. My friend actually has a law degree and has a master's degree and has a PhD.
Wow.
And he went back to help his country, and they're patriots. I mean, they want the same things that we want. They want security. They want opportunity for themselves and for their children. They want good education systems. I mean, they want the same things. It's just they have a bad element there that is what, unfortunately, the world sees. They don't see the good people, you know?
Right.
And we're seeing the good people now. They're at the end of a gun.
Yeah.
He was with me. We worked tasked with being a linguist, which being a linguist can mean a lot of things. You can be an interpreter, you can be a translator, and those mean a lot of different things. You know, a lot of translators, a linguist is a broad term, and an interpreter usually means that they're the ones out in the field with say, an infantry unit. Could be anything from an infantry unit to, a special forces unit, to even a public affairs unit or a civil affairs unit that's going into a village to help dig a well. I mean, there's not a whole lot of troops that speak the native languages there, which are Dari, Pashtun, Urdu. They don't speak those. So we have to be able to communicate. So these guys are hired by the military or non-government agencies, and they go out and they speak the language. They communicate with the local population for us. It could be that, or it could be, I remember one day while I was over there, we had a bombing at the NATO headquarters, the ISAF headquarters, and they asked, I need a linguist right now. I need a translator. And so they went out the gate and were working with the local population, the wounded, that sort of thing. So they put their lives on the line each and every day. And you have those, and then you have the people, too, that do things like atmospherics. And what atmospherics is, they go out in the community and they kind of ask, they go shopping. They look around, they see what's going on, and then they come back and say, okay, look, we've got a problem because inflation is causing the price of bread to go up. So we might have riots in this area over here. So we need to really pay attention to it. There's a whole host of things that they do.
But obviously very important. I mean, that I can see how all that stuff, and then talking to you and talking to, you know, friends of mine, wherever they serve, even in the special forces, they all talk about their translators or how important these people were.
Well, they're so crucial because, you know, if you do get language training before you go overseas, it's usually, a 2-week course kind of thing, a crash course, unless you're in, you know, that's your MOS, that's your job, mm-hmm. is that you're for that particular language. So it's, you're in a foreign land. You don't know how to, they teach you basic terms. They give you a book that has probably, you know, 500 terms in there, and you have to flip through the book to figure out how to say it. But so they're crucial, and they become friends. They become your right-hand man, you know? I mean, they are essential. And then it's not them. You have other people that assist with clerical work, with, I mean, you know, we have people that did all sorts of things, and they worked for us over there because they believed in the dream. They believed in freedom. They believed in that we were going to help them establish a free Afghanistan that provided opportunity for them. And they put their lives on the line for us, and they're doing it right now because the Taliban has list of names, and they're going door to door.
I want to do this. I went up against the news break, and we come back, I want you to talk about this process of getting this individual person, we won't say the name, out of Afghanistan. We return to Chip Brown right here on FM Talk 106.5.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5. Call Sean now at 343-0106.
Get right back to our conversation with District 105 Representative Chip Brown, but a man that spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, has talked with us over the years about the situation in Afghanistan. Currently talking about getting somebody that was crucial to him and others in Afghanistan out. Chip, that process, because we want, you know, Kabul Airport surrounded by the Taliban, which seems like a trap to me for any of the good folks who want to get out. How did this person, we're not going to say their name, but how was that process? How'd they get through?
Well, it ended up Friday. I'll make it quick, but Friday we had a conversation and we spoke, and he was in Kabul, and he's a U.S. citizen, U.S. passport holder, has for years, lives out west, and just a first-class good guy. And he had gone over there. He spent 6 years working there at a very high-level position and did, I mean, a lot of sacrifice for us over there to really work. And I can't tell you what he did because it'll give him away because it was easy.
Still there?
Thing, but yeah. You there?
Yeah. You just cut out for a second. Yeah. All right.
Oh, come, sir. But he has family there in Kabul, so he went to visit them. And Friday night we spoke, and I said, well, I think Kandahar had fallen. And I said, you need to think about getting out. And he said, well, they're telling me, the people he knew at the State Department, they're telling me I have at least 30 days. And this is Friday night. I said, well, if they're telling you 30 days, I would think you probably have maybe a week. And so we spoke again on Saturday. And Kandahar is about the equivalent of here to Montgomery.
Okay.
So that's very close. So he had tried to, he had a flight already, tried to move his flight up to the 17th. And then Sunday morning comes, and I talked to him and said, you got to get out now. And then he went to the airport, and he paid $1,000 for a flight to Turkey. While he's at the airport, there's gunfire in the airport. He saw a gunfight in the airport. And flight crews, the immigration office, everyone starts running out of the airport then because there were some mortars hitting near the airport, that sort of thing. And so they were saying the Taliban's going to be here in an hour, and everybody took off running. So there's no one to fly out. So he goes back home, and he's back home, and then I speak to him, and then the embassy's being evacuated. And so then I made some phone calls. I called Jerry Carl's office, and they helped get him on a list with the State Department. But and then I had some friends with the State Department that do some back channels that put us in touch with a guy that was a Special Forces guy, got him working with an Afghan to get some translators out, and they were trying to help me through him. And but ended up, at one point, I said, look, you just got to go to the military side of the airport. Take your passport, take everything with you, leave your family. And so he went and went to the gate, and there were about, he said there were about 30,000 people at the airport. And he saw the plane and the people fall off of the plane. And
he was there at that point. Wow.
He was there, yeah. And so there was gunfire. And so he goes to the military gate, and they turn him away because he said there were about 5,000 people at the gate. And the Marine told him, look, you got to go back to where you came from, wait to be called. And he was like, I'm a U.S. citizen. Here's my passport. And he has a military ID that's expired, but it's a military ID. And they said, look, we're not opening the gate for anybody. And so
Oh my gosh. He
leaves, goes back to his house, and then he calls me when he gets to his house. And I said, look, you've got to leave now, because if there's that many people now, that's going to end up being the only safe place potentially. And so they left, and he had to go through at least four Taliban checkpoints. They were starting to set him up. Searched him, searched his brother's vehicle. He had to hide his passport, his phone, any kind of Western identification in the vehicle. They, you know, were saying he was trying to say, because he speaks, you know, he's from there originally. He was saying, well, I live here, I'm from here. And the Taliban was telling him, no, you're a Westerner, we're going to do this to you. The big fear is always you get kidnapped and taken to Pakistan, and you just disappear. But so he made his way through, and we had discussed him going to a gate that he and I both knew that was on the north side of the airfield on the military side. And he went there, and they actually let him through. And he got in, and then was able to eventually catch a flight, a military flight to Doha, Qatar, Qatar, and set there. And then now he's back in the U.S. already. And but what we're working now, trying to get his family out. His family's still trapped over there. And he's sending me documents that I'm sending to the State Department to verify, you know, they worked for the military and non-government agencies, and why they need to be out. And they're telling him and that they are more or less sitting in their house with windows bolted, doors bolted, and not making a sound, because the Taliban is in the area going door to door, and they can't walk outside. You can't get to the airport because the Taliban is there, and you can't walk outside because the Taliban is there, and they will kill you.
So they're hiding in their house like they're not there. I mean, if there's knocks on the door or whatever, they're not.
Because what he's telling me that they are telling him and his family and friends in Kabul are that the Taliban is coming in and they have the list, because when they captured, when they went into the embassy, we left our biometric list, which
Is there any way for us to for you to hold over one more segment for us? Because I'm up. The news is going to start here in just a second. I've blown off everything else this hour, but I want to finish this part of the story. So we're going to hold Chip Brown over for a few minutes here, and we'll be right back. This is Midday Mobile on FM Talk 106.5.
There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone, and I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question, kiss my...
Right, welcome back to Midday Mobile on FM Talk 106.5. And we continue our conversation with District 105 Representative Chip Brown. And silly me, I even had questions that I was going to ask him about special sessions and redistricting and all that. We'll save that for another time, because this story that we've been talking about, once again, to set this up, Chip, this is somebody, we're not giving his name, but somebody that was known to you that worked as a translator, linguist, a lot of other things in Afghanistan. Is that right?
That's right. He actually, when we went the first time, he had some, he was one of these people that ends up, he's extremely highly educated, and particularly in the legal field, and he speaks probably five different languages. And so they realized his talent was not being a translator or, you know, a linguist. And so he ended up going and doing some major things inside the, helping the government transition, let's put it that way, with working for, he worked for the department. He was actually a GS-15, which is the equivalent of a colonel. And then he worked for private contractors and that sort of thing as well.
All right. So we're talking about the process of getting him out here. He made, it was like the third attempt before he found that north gate, right?
That's right. And he got in, and he was able to secure a seat on a flight, and they gave him water and everything. But, you know, I had asked him, and then I had someone that's a contact through the State Department had asked me to ask him, too, about how many U.S. citizens were on and that sort of thing. And his comment to me when he was in Doha, when he got out and was in Doha, Qatar, he said that on that flight that he was on, that the majority were not U.S. citizens, that it was a combination of some passport holders like him, but then you had some that were, might be green card holders, but then you had a lot that somehow had gotten on the plane that had no, you know, they might have worked for us and had a paper, let's say, that showed that. But then he said there were other nationalities on there as well, Filipinos, and we called them TCNs, third country nationals, that we had agreements with that would work on the bases and might be a barber or, you know, that sort of thing. But there were several of those on there as well.
So he makes it out, but he couldn't get his family out, right?
Yeah.
And they're still
his
there.
Family,
they're the ones that are closed in, pretending like they're not there at home, right?
Right. He has family that's still there, and he's talking to them constantly. You know, some brothers and some sisters and a mother, and they all worked for our effort over there and have the documentation to prove it. And he's sending me that. I'm sending that on to the right people to get him on the list. But the problem is, just like originally, when he was, I was able to get him on a list. Well, he had to go online. He had called the embassy, actually, on maybe Friday or Saturday, and they told him, go to this website and fill this form out and get your name in the system. So he gets in the system. Well, he does get a text that day that he got out telling him, stay where you are. Don't go to the airport. Don't, don't leave. Don't. And I told him, I said, you got to leave. That's a death sentence because they're going to cut you off and you're going to be sitting there. We're not going to run missions. We're not. The British are, the Germans are, the Spanish, the French. They're actually running missions into Kabul and getting their people and bringing them back to the airport. But we're not doing that. And this administration is saying they're not going to do it. And so I told him, go to the airport and get out. And originally I told him, and they were telling me, tell him to go to the embassy. And then at the same time, he's getting messages saying, don't go to the embassy. So I told him that my contact was saying, get to the embassy. So he left to go to the embassy, and the embassy fell on the way there. And I had to text him and say, turn around, don't go. You know, it's too dangerous. But his family is still there. They all work for him. And, you know, they're basically doors are bolted. Windows are bolted and they can't leave. Don't want to make a sound. People are banging on doors. They have lists. They're going door to door. They know who worked for us. Not only us, but the Australians, the British, the Germans, the French, you name it. And or worked for non-government agencies. Every aid agency in the world was over there doing different things. And so over 20 years, think of how many thousands of people worked for our efforts for over 20 years. And we've just abandoned those people, and the Taliban is going door to door and hunting them, and they're killing them. And if they have a name on the list and they're looking for Sean, if Sean's not there, then they're going to go after his family.
Well, that's what I was about to ask you, Chip, because we're going to have you come back on with us and talk in detail next week on the show. But do you think for this person that you know that got out, if they find his family there that's bolted behind those doors, will Taliban kill them?
They will kill him. Yes.
Now that's as stark as that. That's putting it right there. I mean, his family will be dead.
Sean, that's why people say, how could those people? What did they think they were doing, trying to hang on to that wheel of that plane that's taken off? That's desperation. Because think about it. 20 years ago, we rooted these guys out and we pushed them out that were this brutal. That every weekend they had public executions in the soccer stadium. Cutting heads off. Mm-hmm. They had beard patrols that rode around, and if your beard was not at least, I think it was 3 inches, they had a ruler. They'd measure your beard. If it wasn't that long, then they'd beat you. If you still didn't grow your beard, they'd just kill you. I mean, so they knew that. They had lived through that. And then now we've abandoned them. They're back in, and they know they're going to hunt them down and kill them. So they're desperate to just try to get out and save themselves. So, I mean, on one part, you say, how could they get on that plane? They know they're going to fall off. But if you have no other, you're desperate that you know you're going to die when they come in. And they are executing people. The media will tell you they're not, but they are, because I actually have someone else that's sending me videos from inside Afghanistan from Islamic sites that are showing them executing military officers and more. So.
And that's the information we need, the real information coming out, and hopefully we could talk about it next week more. I mean, it is like I woke up the other day and had this feeling that it's like the stories you read of how when Genghis Khan, the Mongols, would show up, people would throw themselves to their deaths because they knew what they were facing. And this is going on in 2021 with the Taliban.
And the thing is, this administration, this Department of Defense, this State Department, there's no other way that this could turn out. It had to turn out this way with the way that they executed this withdrawal. I mean, we pulled our troops out, but left our people there.
It's insane.
We left our assets there. I mean, who pulls Who pulls their people out when you still have advanced thousands of millions of dollars worth of advanced equipment on the ground? And we don't even know how many people are there. And there's another thing on that, Sean. It might be 10,000. It might be 40,000. But they're not all in Kabul. We have people that were stranded in Bagram, in Jalalabad, in Kandahar, all over. Herat, they're all over the country. If you can't make it 2 miles in Kabul to get to the airport because of the Taliban, how are you going to make it from somewhere that's 300 miles away through the Taliban to Kabul, to the airport? I mean, we had airports there that were open, and we walked away from them. When we walked away from Bagram, we didn't even tell the Afghans we were leaving. We just left the gate open. I mean, we had these, even our most remote, I used to fly and land on dirt runways all the time. We had facilities. We walked away from them. We left all of our equipment, and now we're just leaving those people to die, and it's tragic. It is the most traitorous act I've ever seen by literally anyone in the U.S. government. I mean, they should all resign right now, and if they don't, they should be brought up on charges of treason. And I mean, it's embarrassing, and it's a shame. And this blood of these people in Afghanistan is on their hands, solely on their hands.
Got a lot of people cheering what you're saying, for sure. We'll have to get you back on with us next week to talk more about this.
Sure.
All right.
Sure, I'll be happy to.
All right. There he is, Representative Chip Brown. And I told you all it would be very compelling, man, talking to Chip Brown in the past about what he had seen there, even during the Bergdahl times, and to hear his story of what's going on right now. We'll get more of that next week. He will join us again. And also special guest Bryant Knight from Team Fight or Die is going to join us on Monday as well, going through some of the same things with people that they had worked with in Afghanistan that are now so desperate to get out.